I'm excited about what we're talking about today. I believe we're talking about one of the most abused, overused, and misused words in the entire English language. It's a four-letter word, L-O-V-E. And let me give credit. He didn't originate the idea, but the first person that presented it was a man several years ago, Bob Rigdon at Fried Hardeman, during the Christian training series that took a lot of pressure off me and helped me to understand this subject tremendously. When you say the word I love, you can put a lot of things on the end of it, and it's amazing how many different things we put on it. But I think a fella, my last 14 years in full-time ministry was with the Barry's Chapel Church in Franklin, Tennessee. I retired there April Fool's Day, 2007. And since that time, I've been doing interim ministry. A lot of times when a preacher stays a long time, does a good job, they don't like whoever comes next. I volunteer to be the one they don't like. And so since that time, I've been at Eddyville, Kentucky, 15 months, Hendersonville, Tennessee, 15 months, Cookeville, Tennessee, 16 months, and now we're in Laverne. But when I was at Barry's Chapel, right over the hill from Barry's Chapel, lived a man by the name of Tom T. Hall. And I think he illustrated the common use as well as anybody I've ever heard. He wrote this that said, "I love little baby ducks, old pickup trucks, slow-moving trains and rain. I love little country streams, sleep without dreams, Sunday school in May, and hay." And I've already got past. All righty, let's get back to that. Let's see if we can get that going right. "I love little baby ducks, old pickup trucks, slow-moving trains and rain. I love little country streams, sleep without dreams, Sunday school in May, and hay. I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, bourbon in a glass, and grass." And he didn't say if that's the kind you smoke or mow. "And I love you too. I love honest open smiles, kisses from a child, tomatoes on the vine, and onions. I love winners when they cry, losers when they try, music when it's good, and life. And I love you too." Isn't that a masterpiece? Now, what do you think about that? If I were a 16-year-old boy and a good-looking girl wrote me a poem like that, I'd float about 3 feet off the ground. I wouldn't sleep or need to eat for 3 or 4 days. But if I stopped and thought logically for 15 seconds, I would be insulted, because you're using the same word for me as you do tomatoes and onions and old pickup trucks and all those other things he's talking about. Somehow, we need a better definition of this very, very important word. And so one of the ways that we apply love, the biblical love, to our marriage is understanding what love is not. Love is not an absence of conflict. Acts chapter 15, we find an entire chapter in the Bible on conflict. First of all, there was a conflict of the brotherhood at that time on whether or not you have to be circumcised according to the law of Moses. And they had a conference at Jerusalem, and the apostles and the elders and the brethren all met together and discussed that. But later we find this intense conflict between Barnabas and Saul. They had completed the first missionary journey, and one day as they were talking about that, they said, Paul came to Barnabas, "Let us go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing." But Barnabas was determined to take with them John called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. Then the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another. So Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended to the brethren by the grace of God. Here was an intense conflict between these two brethren. However, they treated each other with respect. They didn't write each other up in brotherhood papers and condemn each other. They went ahead and went about their own business. And one of the most encouraging passages of the entire Bible, 2 Timothy chapter 4, as Paul is nearing his death, he writes to Timothy and says, I want you to come to me quickly. I want you to come before winter. And one of the things I want you to do, take Mark and bring him with you, for he is profitable to me for the ministry. Another interesting interchange was in Galatians chapter 2, verse 11, where Paul said, when Peter was come to Antioch, I rebuked him to the face because he was to be blamed. And he rebuked him for his hypocrisy. But it's interesting what Peter says in 2 Peter 3:15, an account of the long suffering of our Lord is salvation. Listen, even as our beloved brother Paul has also written to you, speaking in them of these things, in which are some things hard to be understood. After he had been rebuked publicly by Paul, he calls him a beloved brother. Love is not denials of feelings of anger, dislike, and irritation. I do quite a bit of work with churches and elderships who are in conflict. And one of the things that I'm intrigued by with families and elders and deacons and human beings of all kinds is, what are your rules? What are your rules? What are your rules? One of the things I start doing when I work with people, I start trying to find out, what are your rules? What are your rules? Family rules are usually unconscious, unspoken, but understood. I believe it's better to have them conscious, spoken, and understood. And so often I send elders a worksheet on, what are your rules? What are your rules? What are your rules of shepherding? What are your rules with the deacons? What are your rules with the staff? What are your rules of your meetings? What are your rules of how you make decisions? And one of the things I ask, what are your rules of feelings? What feelings are allowed and expressed in your meeting and in your interchange with each other? Basically, there are four feeling groups: mad, sad, glad, and scared. It is my understanding that the Bible gives us permission to experience and to feel all of those. I do not believe there's any such thing as bad feelings. They are painful feelings and pleasant feelings, but feelings within themselves are not bad. And one of the most common responses that I get is that we can talk about anything in our meetings except feelings of anger. We can talk about being sad. We can talk about being scared. We can talk about happy things and laugh. But we just have a rule. We don't get angry, or if we get angry, we don't talk about it. It is my experience and observation that we will either talk it out or act it out. Now, I understand that reluctance. I remember several years ago, I was preaching for a congregation. A young lady came to talk to me, and as we were talking, she would say, Jerry, you know, I was doing this, and I got angry. Of course, I realized it's sin to be angry. And I listened some more, and she said, and I got mad. Of course, I know it's a sin to be mad. And about the third time she said that, I said, wait a minute. Who told you that it was a sin to be angry? She said, Brother Barber, the best I can remember, when you preached those 8 years in Madisonville, Kentucky, you preached that it was a sin to be angry several times. I said, you are probably right. But I've studied the Bible since that time, and I've learned better. Ephesians 4:26 says, be angry and do not sin. Another translation says, in your anger, do not sin. Recently, I was reading an article by a Christian writer who said, but it's still a sin, because you go on down in verses 31 and 32, said, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and fornication be put away from you with all malice. Yes, and the reason we need to put that away, and the way we put away bitterness, is by being angry at the right time, in the right way, at the right person, in the right degree. And all bitterness is anger that has not been processed. Maybe anger tonight. Here's the way I've dealt with it many times. Somebody would irritate me. Sometimes it would be my wife or a child, and because we're in close contact, and I'd feel that, and I'd say, I'm going to be a good Christian, not say anything about it. Boy, aren't I being good? And then I'd get irritated again. I'm going to be a good Christian, not say anything about it. I'm going to be a good Christian, not say anything about it. And then finally, the straw that breaks the camel's back, and I burst out, and I feel like I deserve it, because look at all those times I've been a good Christian, didn't say anything about it, so I need to have a good fit every once in a while. No, be angry. and do not sin. What does Paul say? Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Take care of it before you go to bed. I remember Brother Grady Baines in Dalton, Georgia, said when he was a young man and they had recently gotten married, he said, we weren't Christians, but somebody gave us that advice. And he said, we tried to do that all of our life. Before we were Christian, after we were Christian, we tried to settle everything before we went to sleep. And he said, to tell the truth, we have stayed up all night long a few times. But love does not mean that I don't ever get angry or that I do not express that. I know it's not a sin. How do I know? The Bible tells me so because of Mark 3 and verse 5, where it said Jesus looked around at them with anger, being grieved because of the hardness of their hearts. And I know that Jesus didn't sin, Hebrews 4 verse 12. So love is not a denial of the feelings of anger, dislike, and irritation. Love is not having my own way and demanding that everybody agree with my opinion at all times. There are some matters of opinion in the home, in the church. Romans 14 says what we do is we allow people to have those. I think that an application of applying biblical love for our marriage is to continue to understand God's definition of love. Love is not a feeling that you feel when you feel you're going to get a feeling that you never felt before. That's what it is not. In fact, biblical love that we're going to be emphasizing this morning, listen to me, I'm going to say it and then I'm going to read you some authority for it. Biblical love is not a feeling. The biblical love that we are commanded to have is not a feeling. That's powerful. That's powerful. And when people understand that in marriage, it will prevent many sad occasions, some of the saddest occasions in my ministry, when people come in and say, Jerry, we're getting a divorce, and the reason we're getting a divorce is because I don't feel like I love her anymore. Now, I may be a lot of things, but I'll tell you one thing, I'm not a hypocrite. If I don't feel like I love her, I'm not going to make it, so I'm going to just get a divorce. What should you do? Let me tell you what God says you need to do. You need to love your wife even as Christ loved it. I don't feel like it. That doesn't have anything to do with it. That's what we're commanded to do. So let's look. See, the Greeks were much more blessed than we are because they had four words for love. And I'd like for us to look at those. I think, at least for me, it's been very, very helpful. Number one, there is love that's based on physical attraction. We sing a song, love is the golden chain that binds. Well, this particular type of love is not a golden chain, but it's a strong chain. It is powerful. It says that if you are beautiful, if you are attractive, if you have desirable qualities, I will appropriate what is in you for my pleasure and my enjoyment. Now, there's nothing wrong with love based on physical attraction and satisfying that within God's boundaries. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul writes, he says, now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let every man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, he does not use the word eros there, that Greek word, but he's talking about that love based on physical attraction. And he says, not only is right, it is commanded in the marriage union. I like the old King James where he says, defraud ye not one from another. Don't steal from your husband or your wife what belongs to them. You have a pleasure and a responsibility in marriage. Out of marriage, it's wrong. Hebrews 13:4. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So, I need to understand that. If I'm going to have the kind of love that God wants me to have, I need to appreciate, enjoy, and participate that within marriage. That is essential. That's something that God has told us to do. However, that's not the kind of biblical love on which marriage is based and that we promise during the marriage vows when we quote Ephesians 5:25. Secondly, there's a love that's based on family relationships. I've got this as a red chain. It also is very strong and it's fine. That word is used 2 times in the Bible, both of them in a negative sense. Romans 1:31 and 2 Timothy 3:3. And again, I think the old King James has the best translation both times. It says, without natural affection. And in both of those passages, he's discussing people who are so depraved that they don't even love their kinfolks. See, it is natural for family members to love each other. And especially this is true for parents and children. My wife was raised at Child Haven Children's Home in Cullman, Alabama. Great, great experience. When she was growing up there, they called it a home for fortunate children. Not unfortunate children, but fortunate children. And during our early married years, we served as foster parents from time to time. And one of the things that confused me, because I hadn't heard these principles at the time, many times we'd take in a child who had been neglected and many times abused by their parents, and I thought they'd look on us as their friends and their parents as their enemies. But that wasn't true. Even though they had been abused and neglected, there was still this natural affection. It is natural for family members to have an attraction and a love for each other. And Paul was simply saying in these two passages, here are some people who are so degraded they don't even have that natural affection. Somebody said this is the kind of love that will make it possible for brothers and sisters to fuss and fight and claw all year long and still show up for the family reunion. But this still is not the one that we're looking at today and that we want to emphasize as we're talking about biblical love for our marriage. Here's the next one. Love for people that you like. Here's the feeling. And I'm representing this by a very delicate silver chain. And this could be translated, I like you. I enjoy you. Joy in the presence of. And there's something, certainly nothing wrong with that. I'm not against good feelings. The Bible teaches about that. We find this illustrated well in John chapter 11. John chapter 11, Jesus gets a message from his friends. A certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sister sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. And the love he's talking about there in verse 3 is this liking love. It's the feeling love. Lord, the one that you like, your good friend Lazarus, is sick. Now, it's interesting in verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, and that's the word we're going to be talking about a little later on. It's not this one. Now in verse 11, he says, these things he said, after that he said to them, our friend, same word here for the liking, our friend, somebody that we like, somebody we enjoy being around, joy in the presence of, our friend Lazarus sleeps. You remember the story. He went back 4 days later. When he got there, Lazarus had been dead. The sisters were questioning him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother Lazarus would not have died. Both of them said the same thing when they came. And then as they got to talking, Jesus saw her weeping, verse 33. And the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Shortest verse in the entire English Bible, John 11:35, Jesus wept. I'm 66 years old, and that's been one of my favorite passages for most of my life, for two reasons. When I was growing up in the Ship's Bend congregation 3 miles out of Centerville, Tennessee, on Wednesday night when we got through Bible study, we would all line up in the front and we'd say a member verse before we sit down. That's just one of the rules. That's a family rule there. And we had a lot of competition, and I think that's where the seeds of preaching were sowed in my heart when I would quote passages and people would come up and say, you're going to be a great preacher one of these days. And there was a girl named Patsy, and sometimes she would quote two, and if she would, I'd try to get three. I wouldn't beat her, and then if she got three, I'd get Psalm 110, and then if she got four, I'd try to do the Beatitudes. But sometimes I'd be running a little late, and if I was running late, I could always do John 11:35, Jesus well. So I loved it then. But now I love John 11:35 because it tells me much about the character and the heart of Jesus. Now, what did those folks think when they saw Jesus weeping? Did they say he's losing his mind? He's having a breakdown? Look what they said. Look what they said. John 11:36. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. And the word there is this feeling word. See what kind of affection there was. See what kind of connection there was between Jesus and Lazarus. Behold how he loved him. Now, I've said all that to get to here. The fourth kind of love, and we sing that song sometimes, love is the golden chain that binds our hearts in sweet accord. It's the love that God has for man, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. It is the love that we're to have toward God. It's that great commandment, Mark 12:30-31. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. This is the first commandment. The second is like, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, listen to what Mr. Vine says in his complete expository dictionary of Old and New Testament words about this particular kind of love. Concerning this type of love, he said, love can only be known for the action it prompts. God's love is seen in the gift of his Son. But obviously, this is not the love of complacency or of affection. That is, it was not drawn out by any excellency in its objects. And he cites Romans 5:8. But God demonstrates, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. God demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So this kind of love is not saying, I love you because you're making me happy. I love you because you're pleasing me. This is something I have decided to do. It's part of my nature. It was an exercise of the divine will in deliberate choice made without assignable cause save that which lies in the nature of God himself. Okay, that's God's love. Now, Christian love, whether exercised toward the brethren or toward men generally, is not an impulse from the feelings. It does not always run with natural inclinations, nor does it spend itself only upon those for whom some affinity is discovered. And so this kind of love is not a feeling. That's important when we get to Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. When I talk with couples before they get married, we do 6 sessions. And in one of those sessions, we spend a good part of it talking about this word. I usually ask them, let's talk about your vows. I personally think it is a shame for a couple to stand up and repeat vows that they've never thought about or discussed before. I don't want to surprise them. I have a general rule. See, people have rules. I'm intrigued by people's rules. I have a rule that I don't hold people responsible for what they say at weddings and funerals. They're not in their right mind either place. They're in grief and they're under pressure and are the flowers right? And, you know, is it going to rain and all those kind of things. So I think we need to do our thinking before the wedding day. And so we spend some time. I ask them, are y'all going to promise to love each other? Oh, yeah, we're going to do that. Okay, let's talk about that. What does that mean? And we go through this whole thing here. We talk about all these different kinds of love. What is it you're going to be promising? And it is my experience that 5 and 10 years later, many times when they come back and say, I want to get a divorce because I don't feel like I love her anymore, is because of a misunderstanding what they promised to start with. If you're going to promise to feel like you're on your first date for the next 50 years, then you're promising something you won't be able to deliver. I've been married 47 years, and I notice there's something about messed up hair and halitosis early in the morning that just doesn't turn either one of us on. And there's not that ooey, gooey, touchy, feely feeling that we had back at Fried Hardeman when we first met each other and started going out on dates. And so that's not what we're promising. What is it that we're promising? I don't know how people fall in love in South Florida. I know how they did it, and I observed it very carefully in the 11 years I preached in Dalton, Georgia. Our church building was right downtown. There was a big parking lot. There was a Hardwick Bank and a county parking lot right behind us. And the way they did it in Dalton, Georgia, couples would be in cars, and they would circle the parking lot, and then they'd go down this street, and then they'd go down that street, and they'd come back around, and they'd just keep circling all night long. Now, another part of that is you turn up the stereo wide open, and many times when I was in my upper room study there, it would just vibrate the whole church building, those things. And I think the reason they had the stereo turned up, because if they ever turned it down and talked sensibly for 15 minutes, they'd find out they didn't like each other. But that's the way they fell in love. And so finally, somewhere they kind of, I don't know if they'd shouted, what, you want to get married? Yeah, okay. Now, that's not the way it was always done. On a Sunday afternoon in July of 1973, my wife and I took our first trip to Israel. We landed at Nicosia, Cyprus, and we toured that island that afternoon. And we had the opportunity to attend an engagement ceremony. They tell us that they made more of the engagement than they did of the wedding itself. And here's the story we learned that afternoon. They said, this couple are meeting each other this afternoon for the first time in their life. Their parents picked them out for each other when they were babies. The parents have always known they were going to get married. This is the first time they've met. And they were dancing and doing, going all through the ceremonies. If they were Christians, you know what the Holy Spirit through Paul would say to that young man that afternoon? Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church. You know how they got married back in New Testament times? Pretty well the same way. They didn't go to Dairy Queen and get a blizzard. They hadn't been to ball games. They hadn't been anywhere. You know what the command is? You know what the word for those folks is? Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Well, but I don't know if I like her or not. There's times when I don't like her. Man, there's times when I don't like myself. But I'm supposed to treat people right. One of the exercises I do when I'm talking to couples, we're talking about this, I said, y'all love each other? Yeah, we love each other. Incidentally, when I'm doing premarital counseling, I tell them, I don't expect you to learn very much. Of course, I don't do that anytime. One of my rules when I teach anything, try not to learn very much. And so I tell people I don't do premarital counseling primarily to benefit the couple. I do it for my own good. I do not necessarily like to do weddings. Don't have to be a faithful preacher to go to heaven. I do like to encourage people to have Christian homes. And so that's the reason I require 6 sessions. And so the reason I'm doing is because I don't want to stand in front of 2 strangers and try to encourage them to have a Christian home. I want to spend some time getting to know them. And so I'm not doing it for your good. I'm doing it for my good, and so that you can get a $60 discount when you buy your Tennessee marriage license. I don't know if you have that in Florida or not, but if you have 4 hours or more premarital counseling in Tennessee, you get a $60 discount for your marriage license. And so I ask you, do you love each other? Yes, we love. Well, tell me how you feel. And they just come up and it's just good. It's just good. I said, well, good, good. I'm thrilled. But that's not what you're going to be promising each other when we stand out there in the church building here in a few days. What you're going to be promising each other is to treat each other right. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose, Brad, that one of the things you decide to do after you get married, that you're going to live on your husband's income. And you have a good job as a wife. And you're going, after you take out for taxes and Social Security and your church contribution, you're going to put all the rest of that in the savings account until you can buy you a new house. That's going to be your down payment. And you save and you make a chart and you know what your goal is and you're getting close enough. You've already been out shopping, and one afternoon right before you get ready to go make a decision to buy that house, your husband comes in and says, you know, honey, been doing a little looking in the last few days, and depending on who it is, I'll say a Porsche or a pickup truck, depending on where the, you know, you got to go with the culture. A lot of times in Tennessee, it's a pickup truck, and he'll say, honey, I found this really neat four-wheeler. And I've just been thinking how much we would enjoy that. And you know, if we go ahead and have kids and get all these responsibilities and house payment, and you know, that thing would last a long time. I'd go out deer hunting, and of course you like that, and you'd enjoy that. And so I've decided that I'm going to take the money that we have saved up for our house down payment, and I'm going to buy that pickup truck. And what I've decided to do, and I'm sure you're going to be thrilled, I'm going to let you pick out which color. They got several colors. And I want you to take you down to the dealership, and whatever color you want, that's what I'm going to buy. Aren't you thrilled? I have yet to find a bride that's thrilled because of that. What would you do? I'm the husband. We're just role-playing now. What are we going to do? She said, well, I'd tell him not to do it. I'm going to do it anyhow. Well, I don't think it's right. Yeah, it's right. I'm going to do it. It's really right. In fact, it's the nicest thing. It's got a stereo. You'll enjoy that. And I just don't quit until we buy that pickup truck. Now what are you going to do? And after we talk through that, I look at the husband. I say, your wife is young and beautiful and kind and sweet. 10 years later, she weighs 500 pounds, quit the church, and cusses like a sailor. And she says, I want you to go to Dairy Queen and buy me 2 banana splits. What are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to tell her to get on a diet. I don't want on a diet. I want 2 banana splits. Well, I don't like it. That's what I want. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? See, here's part of the commitment we're making. We're making a permanent commitment to an imperfect person. We're not promising to feel good for the rest of our life. We're promising, I'm going to treat you right. That's what you're promising. That's all you can promise, but you can promise that. And that is biblical love that is promised or that's commanded over and over again in the Bible. Now, here's the kicker right here. The thing that helped me see the whole principle. It was not love for God. I thought I understood that pretty well, or my love for God, or husbands loving your wives. Here it is. Here's the key. Here's the key to peace in the church. Here's the key to peace and prosperity and happiness in our home. It's Matthew 5, 43 and 44. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. There's a key to it. And here's the one that always gave me trouble. When I would read that, I would say, oh me, I'm not anywhere close to that. Maybe when I'm 80 or 90 years old, I'll start having these warm, fuzzy, close feelings to people who spit in my face and kick me in the shins, either literally or figuratively. But I don't feel that way now. I don't like them. But Jesus says I'm supposed to love my enemies. But I don't love them. I don't like them. How am I going to do that? I don't know how to reconcile this. And here's the key. What Jesus is teaching in Matthew 5, 43, 44 and following, it's okay to love people you don't like. Whoopee. I can do that. I can do that if it's okay not to like them. One Sunday morning I had preached this. We got an invitation to go home with some people that night after services. And this lady said, Jerry, I need to talk to you about the sermon this morning. She said, you taught it, and you taught it right, because it's read in my Bible. Jesus said it. Jesus says, love your enemies. There's a man in this town, and I despise him. And I'd probably go to hell if I died tonight because of the way I feel toward him. Help me with it. I said, man, that is serious. Because Jesus said, love your enemies. Let me ask you a question. If you could have anything in the world that you wanted for that man, what wish would you have? She said, I would wish that that man would repent of the way he treats people and do right. I said, oh, that is wonderful. You love that man. Oh, she said, no, I hate the man. I said, okay, let me ask you another question. I realize that many times when people have hurt us deeply, that it can be difficult. But do you think that praying God to give you grace, that maybe within 6 months you would be able to pray to God to bless that man? Oh, she said, I prayed for him. I said, man, you don't have a problem. You love that man. She said, I hate his guts. I said, okay, let me ask you another question. Let's suppose that you knew, somebody told you, that that man had had nothing to eat for 39 days. If he goes another 24 hours, he'll tie the record of Elijah and Moses and Jesus. Would you be willing to go through the drive-thru at McDonald's, get him a small fries and a small burger and leave it on his front porch and let him know that he had... Oh, she said, I wouldn't want him to starve to death. I would feed him. I said, you have no problem whatsoever. You love this man. She said, I hate him. Now, Matthew 5... Romans chapter 12. Paul says, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. Therefore, if your enemy hunger, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink, for in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Question. What did Jesus and Paul, how did he tell us to feel toward our enemies? He didn't tell us any feelings. He told us what to do for our enemies. Pray, bless, get them something to eat, give them a drink of water. Those are actions, not feelings. Neither Jesus nor Paul tells me how to feel toward my enemies. Now think about it. Here's where it gets down where I can understand it. The fact that I don't like them makes them my enemies. If I like them, they would be my friends. Friends are people I like. Enemies are people that I don't like. And Jesus said you need to treat people right, the ones that you like and the ones that you don't like, but you treat everybody right whether you like them or not. Wow, if I can do that for enemies, I can do it for Gail, my wife. That makes sense? That makes sense to me. It finally clicked. Now, don't always do it the best, and if she is here, she'd say amen very quietly so as to not to usurp any authority or anything, but that's the key to it. And so when somebody comes to me and says, we're going to get a divorce because I don't feel like I love her anymore, Brother Barber, what do you think I ought to do? You ought to love her. I don't feel like that. That's it. That's a challenge. There's where you start. See, love for enemies is the distinctive Christian love. Anybody, he said, anybody can salute those who salute them. Anybody can love those who love them. Anybody can treat people right who treat them right. He says when you're really showing that you're like your Father who is in heaven is when you treat people right who don't treat you right. Or as Paul put it in 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind, and envies no one. Love is never boastful, nor conceited, nor rude, never selfish, not quick to take offense. Love keeps no score of wrongs, does not gloat over other men's sins, but delights in the truth. There's nothing love cannot face. There's no limit to its faith, its hope, and its endurance. Love will never come to an end. He's not talking about the feeling, he's talking about the commitment. And so the commitment is Matthew 7, verse 12. Therefore, all things, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So, how do I practice biblical love in my home as I treat my spouse and my children right? And there are several practical ways to do that. Eating together. talking, which involves listening. Someone says there are people who have a relationship that wild horses couldn't pull apart, but a whining tongue can separate it quickly. Many people would be willing to die for someone who will not listen to their complaints. Sharing experiences, being interested, smiling, eye contact. One of the things that Brother Rigdon pointed out I thought was neat, sometimes eye contact is showing love, sometimes breaking eye contact is showing love and grace towards someone. And he pointed out John chapter 5. Remember that story? They brought this woman and said, here's a woman who's calling adultery the very act. Law says y'all based on what are you saying? He writes in the ground. And when Jesus stands up, he said, okay, we're going to have a rock throwing party, and here's the rules for the rock throwing party. We're going to let the person who has never committed a single sin in their life start out, and everybody else can follow. But what did he do? Stare him down? No, he stooped down and he broke eye contact and he wrote on the ground again. And by the time he looked up, he and the lady were the only two left. And so he let them get out without being stared down. Sometimes you look at people, sometimes you break eye contact with people. You do whatever would be helpful to them. Touch, doing things together, working together, helping another in need, common enjoyment of some pleasure, having grace toward other people. I read someone who said, if a friend calls you and says, I am in jail, and you say where, you are his friend. If you say why, you're not. Job 6 verse 14 says that a friend is someone who will show kindness toward you even when you have denied the Lord your God. That's powerful. I need to treat people right even when they're doing wrong, because if I don't, I'm cutting my nose off to spite my face, because I'm going to do wrong and I'm going to need a friend somewhere, sometime. Recently, I was in a meeting where there was church conflict and some people told me we didn't come this morning because we couldn't worship with these people here this morning. And how are you going to do that if you come and worship with them? Because they're sinners. I said, well, I figure I'll be able to handle that pretty well. I've been worshiping with sinners all my life, every Sunday. I believe I can tolerate these. Having grace toward others. Being forgiving, being patient, laughing together, dying for another. This is the way Jesus demonstrated his love. Say it and mean it. I love you. Do you love me or do you not? You told me once, but I forgot. We need to continually be remembered and be reminded of the love that we have toward each other. Now, I hope I have not left the impression that I don't like good feelings. I do. If I have a choice between painful feelings and pleasant feelings, I choose the pleasant. If I have that, I like it. I like to be liked. I like to like other people. However, my commitment is I'm going to treat you right whether I like you or not. Now, here's the payoff is that many times when we treat each other right, we feel good toward each other. Look at a couple of passages where it uses both of these in the same verse. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22. Seeing you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit, in sincere love of the brethren, that's the feeling, see that you love one another with a pure heart fervently. First one is the feeling, second one is the action. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. But concerning brotherly love, this is the feeling, but concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love, that's the command, treat each other right, to love one another, and indeed you do so toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia, but we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more. You've been taught to love and you do that. Love is something that you do. But I'm to treat others right regardless of how I feel. As you would that men should do to you, do even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. It is only when that is broken that a relationship is broken. Listen to Hebrews 13 verses 8 through 10. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, all are summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. And so love is the golden chain that binds. Not the physical, although there's a place for that, and it is wonderful when it is within the confines of the love that God commands us. It's not the family love, although that's good and it's natural. We need to cultivate that, and we have the love that God commands us to have. We'll have better family relationships. It's not the feeling love, although that's good, and we'll usually have better feelings when we treat each other right. But the real commitment and the thing that glues it all together is when I do what God tells me to do. Thank you for being here. May God bless us as we love Him with heart, soul, mind, and strength, and others as ourselves.